Hello, everyone. This is Marquise Olison, host of the Vote Plan 2020 podcast. I am here with the one and only Matt Wigler. Matt has so many accomplishments. I'm not going to try to name them all, but I'll just try to name a few. He was vice president of the College Democrats at Stanford University. He served in the UN under the UN General Security. Hold on. What was that, right?
The UN. I was an intern for working on the UN Security Council in New York.
This man was working on the UN Security Council in New York. He served in Pete Buttigieg's as a foreign policy advisor on his foreign policy advisory team. He's amazing. Like, let me tell you. This is one of those things where if you look at this man's resume, you would think he was like 45 years old, but he's 23.
I hope I don't look that old.
On your resume you do, but not like in life. In life you look actually like 26. You could probably go to a bar and drink what you can legally right now anyway. Your resume stands out of somebody that has accomplished a whole lot. There are people that are twice my age that would say, I would love to be able to advise a presidential candidate that got within a hair's breadth of actually being the nominee.
Experience yourself, Marquise. I'm just impressed to be on your show.
Thank you.
You know, now, sharing in this luminous spotlight that you've got.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's one of these things where I only have a spotlight because brilliant, amazing, wonderful people have shared it with me. And with that gift comes the responsibility of making sure you shine it on others. And like, if you're already 23 and you're doing the things that you're doing in this world, and one of the things that we're going to talk about with Matt is the fact that Matt worked the polls at the very beginning of COVID-19. And when we're talking about planning for voting and planning for election day, he can talk about what it was like to actually be a poll worker while a pandemic was happening. And let's everybody virtually welcome Matt to the podcast. So what's beautiful in your world today?
What's beautiful in my world today? Well, so New York is actually in a pretty good place. Today is our lowest day of coronavirus infection rates since the start of the pandemic. And I'm sure you remember and the viewers remember that at the beginning of the pandemic here in New York, we were amongst the hardest hit in the world. We were a global hotspot of the virus, having to do with the high density of the living situation in the city, and also the fact that we're such a global hub. People were coming from Europe, bringing in the virus. Now, as a result of, good governance by Governor Cuomo and his team, and especially, the cooperation of, just the people of New York who cared about each other's health in wearing masks and staying inside, we've hit a point where we're amongst the safest states in the country and we have the lowest rate of transmission that we've had since this thing began. Hopefully we keep it that way. I mean, while the rest of the country is shooting up, I feel very lucky to be here now and very proud to be a New Yorker.
And it's interesting because we're now in the debates about whether to open up schools. It's almost like we're going right back to that beginning of where we were in the pandemic, where we're like, should we shut down or should we stay open? Should we send the kids to school or should we not? It's interesting to see how everybody's approaching this decision in different ways.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the question depends so much on the context of the particular state or even the particular region that you're in. Governor Cuomo made the call yesterday that K-12 education can go forward in the state of New York, facilitated by those low transmission rates. And I think that's great that we can do that. You know, we shut down and we endured sacrifices. We didn't go get haircuts and we didn't go get tattoos because we wanted to be able to open up K-12 education at this point. There are other states where the rate of transmission is just too high to conceive of opening schools up safely for the students, for their families, who those students go home to, and especially for the teachers who put themselves on the line to go and educate our youth. So I think it really depends on where states are in their transmission rates. And I think that it's important to make those sacrifices early to you know, skip out on those unessential activities, because I think education is essential. And I think going to school is an essential thing for teachers, for students. That's how we build tomorrow. We talk about, you know, getting a vaccine that will end coronavirus. It's having an education system of the highest caliber accessible to all children in the United States. That allows us to have the scientific know-how and the smarts to accomplish such tasks as that. So I think it's an essential function, but we can't do it if it's not safe. We have to have an online classroom. And that's why we really need to get the virus under control. And I wish we had, instead of this patchwork of 50 different COVID responses from 50 different governors, I wish that the President of the United States had taken the responsibility incumbent upon that office and spearheaded a nationwide 50-state coronavirus response, so all of us could be in the same place where New York is right now, where we feel we can safely go ahead and open K-12 education, instead of having some states where that just isn't feasible safely and we're going to throw teachers into harm's way. I feel lucky right now, as someone who's about to become an educator for the first time, that I'm heading off in 2 weeks to the United Kingdom to begin teaching in person, because over there it's safe. They had a more unified response to COVID than we did. And, you know, the boon of that, the benefit of that, is that they get to have in-person education. And as a teacher, I'm going over there feeling like I'm going to be safe, perhaps safer than I would be in most states, you know, in my own country. And that's not good. I wish that we all had that same sense of safety and security. In South Korea, they call teachers nation builders. I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, we shouldn't be putting them into harm's way. We should be making sure that in other sectors of society, just like we went out there to protect nurses and doctors who were treating COVID as frontline responders earlier, we should be doing the same thing for teachers so that they could carry out their essential functions in safety.
You're heading, like you said, you're heading to the UK in 2 weeks. You were actually in Ireland when you were working the elections.
That's right.
Tell me about that. How did that happen? How did that start? And then what was it like to go from a reality where, oh yeah, this everything's fine, to the world is about to change? And at the time, we had no idea how the depths of that change.
Yeah, no, it all happened very suddenly. And I'm sure that was your experience too, and everyone else's, that, you know, you saw it creeping in the news headlines, but then all of a sudden we were living in a different world than we were before. I guess let me backtrack. I was in Ireland from August 24th through March 13th. I was supposed to be there through the year, but I was a George J. Mitchell scholar at Trinity College Dublin, earning a master's degree in international politics. I was doing research on peace negotiations and peace referendums in Northern Ireland and Colombia, sort of trying to figure out why did peace referendums succeed in Northern Ireland but fail in Colombia when they were held. And so I've been doing that research. And while I was there, I was also very involved with Democrats Abroad Ireland, which is what gave me the opportunity to be one of the poll workers, poll volunteers, for the Democrats Abroad primary, which in Dublin was held on Super Tuesday. And so the headlines that I was reading at that time were very focused on the election, the primary election, and how different candidates were responding to the challenges that COVID seemed like it would pose. I don't think any of us had any sense at that point for exactly what the magnitude of this crisis would be. I guess my first inkling was that while I was a poll worker in Dublin, in addition to checking in voters and, you know, counting through and verifying the ballots, one of my duties was also to go up to the voting station with, you know, Windex and rubber gloves and wipe everything down to make sure that people weren't infecting each other trying to vote. Now we know that mail-in ballots are probably the safer option to vote than, you know, voting in person. And they tend to be, you know, more reliable, more accurate, more secure as well. So I think seeing a transition to more mail-in voting and implementing universal mail-in voting is going to be a good thing. And, you know, come this general election, I will be voting by mail from the United Kingdom.
We're going to get into your vote plan in a little while, because there's probably thousands of Americans that are still in foreign countries. But you said something there that was really, that I really want to. You said that mail-in ballots are more secure and more accurate. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, studies show again and again that, you know, mail-in voting, people have concerns, mainly because the president is, you know, trying to delegitimize mail-in ballots because he wants to cast askance on the tools of an election that he thinks he's about to lose, when it really has nothing to do with the tools and everything to do with the terrible response Trump has had to COVID that he's worried about losing. But studies have shown again and again that mail-in ballots are reliable, that it's a electoral system of great integrity. The Postal Service has a fantastic method of delivering mail, and unlike election results that are based on electronic systems, there's less of a risk of, you know, hacking and the influence of outside powers being at play as a distortionary factor. Plus, if you look at electronic voting machines, they are riddled often. I don't want to say riddled, because the truth is that these things are, you know, rare, but it's possible that there are, and there have been in the past, malfunctions, difficulties where some votes get lost. That happens much, much less frequently with mail-in ballots. So you could be even more sure of the validity and integrity of mail-in ballot results than you are of, you know, in-person results. And in-person results from, you know, electronic voting machines, from the little poll lever machines that we've had in New York for the longest time, those are valid too. I don't want to say that they're not, but mail-in ballots are every bit as valid, if not more so, because they're less susceptible to those rare glitches that might sometimes occur otherwise.
I want to go back to Ireland.
Okay.
Because we all experienced in this world where there was an emergency order and the world just changed. And it didn't happen too far out from when that election occurred.
Days later.
Walk me through what it was like being Matt Wigler, going from working the polls to serve democracy for folks that are citizens of this country but living abroad, to hearing that your world and everything that you know had to change within minutes.
Yeah. Well, so I had been planning on spending St. Patrick's Day in Ireland, which was on March 17th. And I had had some friends who were planning to come visit me from the United States for that. And I remember literally the day before I found out that I would have to be leaving, getting evacuated from the country. You know, I was on the phone with my friends and we were discussing whether the trip would be able to go forward or not, whether they would be flying from the United States to Ireland to come spend St. Patrick's Day with me drinking Guinness and Temple Bar, rather than the reverse, me packing up all of my stuff that I thought I was going to be using till June and coming back home to quarantine with my family. It all happened very quickly. I had been living at the dorms in Trinity College Dublin, you know, in this beautiful building overlooking the Campanile, you know, over the iconic green manicured lawns, like this collegiate dream. The same dorms that, you know, Oscar Wilde had lived in when he was a student at Trinity, and I loved it there. That was my favorite, you know, little fact that I would always throw in when I was talking to people about it, because I'm a big Oscar Wilde fan. You know, all of a sudden, as I'm talking with my friends about making this trip, I see President Trump says within 48 hours, nobody from Europe is going to be able to fly back to the United States. Of course, there are going to be exceptions for U.S. citizens coming home, we later find out, but the news conference is just no more flights for Europeans coming back to the United States. I'm like, okay, maybe it's time to leave. Shortly on the heels of that, I got an email from Trinity saying, hey, everybody has to leave the dorms by the end of the weekend. Take all of your stuff with you. Nobody's coming back. So I'm like, okay, shoot. So now I have no housing, potentially no way to get home. And then the travel health insurance company that I had been using for insurance coverage while I was in Ireland writes to me and says, starting 7 days from today, we're not going to cover any COVID cases abroad. So go home. So at that point, I realized, all right, it's really time to go home, pack the bag up on my year abroad, which had been a lot of fun. I was able, luckily, and I know some other people weren't, to get a ticket back to the United States on the last flight before the travel ban was supposed to take effect on Aer Lingus, and that was Friday the 13th, an auspicious date, right? So I found myself on this really crowded flight from Dublin back to New York JFK, filled with, you know, lots of other students studying abroad, lots of expats who are trying to get home, not knowing how long they were going to be away from their lives in Ireland, how long they were going to be in the United States for. You know, some people left important things, most of their clothing behind because they thought, hey, maybe this will be a month, maybe this will be 2 months, then I can go back. Obviously, it was a lot longer than that. And I was one of the people who didn't know how long it was going to take. I thought, gee, I missed out on, you know, half of my year in Europe. I'd like to have more. So I applied to this teaching fellowship at Eden on the plane back from Ireland, thinking it would be a chance to travel around Europe again. It's not going to be a chance to travel around Europe again. It'll be a very different experience than, you know, any of us could have imagined. But I think it'll be a wonderful way to spend the year, you know, educating young people about politics and about history at a really critical time. And I'm grateful for that experience. I've always had a Hogwarts fantasy. So this is sort of going to be my way of living that out in the UK for a little bit.
Were there any of those moments where it's like, remember those 1970s suitcases commercials where you had to hurdle, you had to run through the airport, carrying your luggage, fight your way through, hurdle, and everybody else is like scrambling to get those last seats?
Yeah, it was busy. Which is interesting because if the idea is that you want flights to be, you know, sparser so that you don't have transmission on those flights, and if you want less air traffic to happen to the United States, which I think was sort of the idea then, when you announce that there's going to be a travel ban coming into effect in 48 hours, that's a great way to ensure full flights packed to the brim with passengers from Europe coming into every airport in America. For that next 48-hour period. You really clog it. You really make sure that there's high density and that there are a lot of people coming over. I wonder what would have happened if they had given more time or, you know, if there had been, you know, a more forgiving way of letting people come across the ocean. I have friends, Americans, who just because the prices got jacked up so much, the flight that I took luckily was covered by my scholarship program, but it was over $1,500 for a one-way ticket from Dublin to JFK. I know friends who weren't able to afford that and who had to stay in Ireland for longer as a result.
Wow. Sometimes we take for granted the idea that all of these things, all of these decisions that come down from the presidency on down, they have an effect on your everyday life and pocketbook. Like we all saw in the news media where these travel bans and everything happened, but then to think through what it's like being the person on the other end of, oh snap, I'm actually affected by this thing that the president just said on TV.
Yep. Yep. And all of a sudden the tickets shoot up in price and you see the demand there growing and you get on a flight and, you know, every seat is filled.
Wow. You worked on nuclear policy, is that right?
Yeah. So when I was an intern at the U.S. mission to the UN in the summer of 2017, I was working on the sanctions policy team. And I came in at the beginning of July, and then it was literally my second day of work. And it was July 3rd, 2017, our 4th of July Independence Day weekend, that Kim Jong-un over in Pyongyang, North Korea, decided to celebrate the 4th of July with some fireworks of his own for the United States and launched his very first successful intercontinental ballistic missile test, which, you know, theoretically, if they could attach a warhead to an ICBM, would give North Korea the capacity to launch a nuclear warhead, you know, that would reach the United States and could obliterate an American city from the map. So, you know, everyone came back from work. Ambassador Haley came back from vacation to work. You saw Ambassador Haley tweeted controversially, oh, thank you, Kim Jong-un, for ruining my 4th of July weekend. And that began a process of, you know, a month of negotiations with, you know, allies and adversaries alike on the Security Council, Russia, China, the UK, France, the elected 10 members of the Security Council, to kick into gear negotiating a sanctions resolution against North Korea to severely limit their ability to funnel hard cash into their nuclear program, their illegal and dangerous nuclear program that posed a threat to the peace and security of the entire world. And after a month of, you know, some really intense negotiations that I was honored to be able to play a role in, along with a staff of really talented diplomats and the U.S. ambassador herself. We were able to pass unanimously, which is a rare achievement in these sorts of things, because China, which is often an ally to North Korea, was willing to play along. And, you know, we worked really hard to make sure that they were on board with all of the restrictions that we were putting on North Korea after that. But we got a unanimous Security Council resolution, UNSCR 2371, that at the time was the toughest toughest sanctions resolution, multilateral sanctions resolution from the Security Council that North Korea had ever faced, cutting off more than $1 billion from their government that they were then no longer able to use to pursue nuclear weapons. And at the time, that was basically, you know, the boldest action that we could take short of war to limit the threat that North Korea posed to international security. And the most important thing, you know, beyond the $1 billion that we cut off from their economy, was that we were able to show as a united front that multilateral diplomacy works and that the world was united in this issue, that even China, who oftentimes is a friend to the Kim Jong-un regime, was standing with the rest of the world here and denouncing this. And you would think that would be enough, but then just a few weeks later, we had to kick into gear and pass again UNSCR 2375, which, you know, beat out 2371 as being, again, you know, combined with this one. Now we have the toughest sanctions regime against North Korea ever, because North Korea had then, you know, launched another missile over Japan shortly after 2371 passed, probably in retaliation. But that that was the summer of fire and fury. You'll remember President Trump's statements in Bedminster then became the title of a popular book. And there was a real sense, as diplomats in Turtle Bay were working on securing these sanctions resolutions, that the alternative to peaceful multilateral action to counter the nuclear program could be something much more destructive, much more violent. You know, the possibility of war loomed very large at that time. And instead, we were able to get these sanctions resolutions through that I think played a role in forcing Kim Jong-un to the negotiation table, which we would see play out later. You had the historic meetings between Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in, and then ultimately meetings between Kim Jong-un and President Trump that I think were made possible in part by those sanctions resolutions. And I wish that the U.S. had played, that the president had played a winning hand more strongly in those negotiations. I think that they were a wasted opportunity, but I think the fact that we were able to get Kim Jong-un to the table finally means a lot, because that's what we were calling for in those resolutions, was for a resumption of negotiations over the North Korean nuclear program, that had to be on the table, or else there was no table at which to resolve our differences. You know, right now we're in a precarious place again, but I think that we are in a safer position because these multilateral sanctions exist than we were before. It does play a very important role in limiting the speed at which North Korea is able to make advances in their nuclear program and put us all at risk.
Wow. It's interesting to think through the challenges that are posed right now at a nuclear level. We all kind of take for granted, just like we're talking about the travel order, that for most Americans sitting within the United States of America, when we heard the travel ban that happened from China and from Europe, most of us were completely unaffected. We just heard them as words that happened. And then you're actually a person who was like, no, those words actually have gravity and meaning to the money that I can spend, to like people leaving their clothes where they are, to actually how my life functions. And it's interesting to think through when we're, for the average American citizen, nuclear policy is another one of those things where it's just like, okay, there's this thing that exists. But at the same time, you understand the insides, or you're like looking at it from a very close view of how this is where world wars actually start.
Sort of Damocles hanging over all of our heads. You know, we don't like to think about it, but at any moment, there are world leaders, far too many of them, I might add, who could hit a button and obliterate a major city from the face of the earth. You know, and that's hanging above our heads at all times. And I think it's a miracle, actually, that given the number of nuclear weapons in the world and the number of individuals of varying character and intentions and mental capacity who have the ability to drop and launch and drop those nuclear weapons, that there has not been since, you know, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings that ended World War II, when the United States and President Truman made probably one of the most difficult decisions a president ever had to make, to end the war and avoid a ground invasion of Japan by dropping those bombs. But since then, that there has not been any nuclear bombings, I think is a miracle. And I hope it stays that way. And I think the only way to really assure that is to get rid of nuclear weapons, which, you know, is a gargantuan policy task for anyone who wants to do that in a realistic way.
If you were in charge, and now having lived through a couple of crises where you were actually in the table and seeing how this gets negotiated from an up close level, what are the things that we need to bridge as a world in order to get closer to a place where we can actually dispense with nuclear weapons?
That would be really difficult to achieve, in part because nobody wants to be the first person to do it. And any kind of denuclearization scheme is going to be very tit for tat, and it's going to have to take into account the security concerns that nuclear states have, and also the concerns of the states that are under our nuclear umbrellas. Our nuclear weapons protect not just the United States, but protect other countries around the world. They protect South Korea, for example, and that's, you know, a big part of the whole Korean Peninsula puzzle, is the role that we play protecting them. And I think that's why North Korea wants nuclear weapons themselves, is that they could then have, you know, this potential to decouple American and South Korean security interests and try and undermine our alliance with each other, making a U.S. president ask, do I want to trade San Francisco from Seoul in the event of a war? So back to the question, I think that if you were to get rid of nuclear weapons, you would have to just change our attitudes around what our security risks are. And you would have to make sure that everybody was to denuclearize in a commensurate way, and in a reciprocal way, that, you know, right now seems difficult to imagine. It would involve negotiations with so many different countries. The US, Russia, China, India, the UK, France, Israel. You'd need to make sure that other countries then you could verify that other people are actually getting rid of their nuclear weapons. And you'd probably want it to be irreversible too. When you talk about denuclearization efforts, you talk about things being verifiable and irreversible. And that's hard to achieve on a level when we're talking about how to make sure that states like North Korea and Iran don't have nuclear programs. So how do you do that with a state like Russia? It's very hard to do. But that doesn't mean that it's impossible to do one day. And of course, the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, does talk about one day finding ourselves in a nuclear-free world, that the great powers, which also happen to be the five permanent members of the Security Council who have sort of the sanctions, the kosher nuclear weapons in the world right now, that we are supposed to eventually start working to get rid of those. And I hope that we will take serious steps towards that one day, because that is our treaty obligation and it would make the world a better place. But it's a difficult question. Yeah, I think in the short term, we're focused more on how do we make sure that Iran, how do we make sure that North Korea don't have nuclear weapons? How do we make sure that other rogue states don't, that, you know, terrorist groups don't find themselves in possession of a nuclear weapon? And then we think about how do we honor those NPT commitments to create a nuclear weapon-free world while making sure that other countries can harness the miracle of, you know, nuclear energy used for peaceful purposes, which is great and which is one of the best solutions that we have, I think, to climate change, if it can be done peacefully and without accident, which is a big if.
You know, in some regards, the nuclear debate sometimes to me feels a lot like the Second Amendment debate. Because you have a lot of, it's basically, if you scale the Second Amendment to being about a person's ability to have a weapon that can end life. And my ability to do that is what defends my other rights. And so you have these other countries that are in that same race where they're saying, I want to have my Second Amendment right, or I want to have the right to bear the ultimate arm to be able to harm you because you have that same power and ability over me.
Well, it's very interesting the way that you describe it there, because you see that in the rhetoric of some nuclear weapon states that want to be recognized as legitimate holders of nuclear weapons under the NPT. India, for example, Prime Minister Singh a while back actually published an op-ed where he was like, it's time to end nuclear apartheid. And the way that he framed the whole nuclear thing was he framed it as an equity issue between, more developed nations in the developing world, where, countries like India that had borne the brunt of, colonization by the British and an unequal global economic system, that it was their right, quote unquote, to have a nuclear weapon, and that it shouldn't just be, this powerful destructive force that's monopolized by countries in the West. I think that rhetoric is very dangerous, because I think that the existence of nuclear weapons makes the world more dangerous for everybody. It's Indians and Pakistanis who are, vulnerable because India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons aimed at each other. And I think that if there were to be a nuclear war in our lifetimes, I think that's the most likely place for it to emerge. And the casualties from that would be catastrophic. An accident between those two countries resulting in a standoff could be catastrophic. And I remember just last year, there were concerns an event like that could happen when tensions were rising on that very volatile India-Pakistan border. And I think that that region in particular, South Asia, where we have those nuclear neighbors, demonstrates perhaps most clearly today what the risks of a nuclearized society look like, and why it is desirable that, non-proliferation and deproliferation should be, goals on the nuclear agenda.
Now, with that, with having these things with trying to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and when we're looking at that sort of rhetoric of, I want my right to be able to own my, city-ending, world-ending gun. what kind of worldwide incentives can we offer? Because like what's been successful sometimes in, looking at the Second Amendment, you have some states that have used gun buyback programs to be like, we will buy your guns from you in order to make our city safer, and we will give you either money or credit or whatever it is. What are the types of things that we could give as carrots to these states that want to be nuclear or that are nuclear in order to get them to give up the stick of having a nuclear weapon?
Right. On a broad scale, you go back to Eisenhower and the Atoms for Peace program, where, you promise not to have a nuclear weapon, and then we can help you to develop, a peaceful nuclear energy generating capacity to fuel, the growth of your cities and, clean development. I think that's still, a powerful formula. And nuclear energy has tremendous potential. It's the risks that nuclear weapons pose, and also that nuclear accidents could pose from nuclear energy done poorly, that make it, a proposition that some people get a little bit nervous about. But I think the toughest question is when you look at a state like North Korea, how do you get them to give up their nuclear weapons? And you had something like that emerge in the agreed framework under Bill Clinton, when North Korea did give up its nuclear weapons in exchange, or alleged to have given up its nuclear weapons program. It turned out during the Bush administration that they had been lying, doing a little bit of nuclear weapons development on the back burner. But I think the basic formula works, where we had agreed to help them to develop a peaceful nuclear energy development capacity in exchange for them giving up their nuclear weapons program. And I think that that's important. That's something that was a part of the Iran deal as well. And as we look at making a new deal with North Korea, I think that that's definitely going to have to be on the table. Basically, the formula is that you build up this enormous pressure, this overwhelming pressure. I think Trump's policy is sort of a maximum pressure one on North Korea, or at least that's what we were working towards at the U.S. mission to the U.N. as we were developing those sanctions. And then you start gradually to lift those sanctions as North Korea meets various benchmarks for denuclearization. And that process has to be, you know, verifiable and irreversible. That's very important. You don't want them to be able to just turn it back on at any point. And you want to make sure that, you know, they can't cheat on the side like they have in the past. Yeah, so in enforcement is difficult. You also don't want to get rid of the sanctions before they've begun the process of denuclearization in a verifiable and irreversible way, because those sanctions are very hard to pass, for one thing, and they're even harder to enforce, especially with their neighbors, Russia and China, and the neighbors matter most. So you want to make sure that you have those sanctions in place, the multilateral ones and the unilateral ones, but especially the multilateral ones, because those are so much harder, until critical benchmarks are reached.
Now, something interesting in there is what we're essentially talking about, that what we have right now is, you know, what we began with in, what was the year that the nuclear weapon was developed?
1945 was the first use of the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It started with the Los Alamos tests in New Mexico, and Oppenheimer's famous quote, "What hath God wrought?"
Mm-hmm. Now, how do we, because the challenge becomes, what we're in essence is talking about ideas. Someone thought of something, in this case, thought of something that could be dangerous. And then was able to marshal forces to put it into practice. With the growth of, you know, millionaires and billionaires who are putting their mental capacity and capital behind doing things like, in this case, like Elon Musk doing something as spectacular as, I'm going to do space flight, which, you know, decades ago could only be thought in terms of a country. But now an individual is saying, no, I'm going to use my money to do this. How do we get, or how do we, in essence, get to a place where some crazy millionaire billionaire doesn't just start hiring brilliant scientists to start working towards their own goals on some hidden island somewhere in the Pacific or in the Atlantic to build their own nuclear capacity?
I mean, unfortunately, it's become very easy to develop a, I wouldn't say a full nuclear program, because those are still prohibitively expensive and the materials are very difficult to acquire. So I don't think it's a risk of, you know, individuals creating nuclear weapons, but I think the risk of nuclear weapons falling into the wrong hands, or more likely, and, you know, just as worryingly, radiological materials needed for a devastating radiological attack on, you know, an American city or any city around the world. Those realistically very easily could get into the hands of someone who would do mischief with them, non-state actors, terrorist groups. There was very real concern that ISIS could have come into, you know, control of radiological materials needed to create improvised radiological devices. They took over a university when they took over, you know, a territory the size of Great Britain in Iraq and Syria. They came into control of, you know, universities and research laboratories that had radiological materials, where there was very real concern that they could create a radiological weapon. And you don't have to be, you know, a major genius to create a radiological weapon. It's far too easy. And a terrorist group that has those sorts of materials in their possession could create a explosion that has nuclear fallout, you know, for weeks, that could make the downtown of a major city uninhabitable for a while. And that could have devastating effects on life, on our economy, and create just an atmosphere of fear, you know, similar to what we've seen with the pandemic, where, you know, people are, you know, just afraid to go outside in, you know, the economic engines of America. So that's one of the most terrifying possibilities, I think, that definitely keeps nuclear experts up at night, is the possibility, not even of nuclear weapons falling into the wrong hands, but of radiological materials falling into the wrong hands that give non-state actors the capacity to explode a radiological device in a populated area.
Now, the question of if we want to, because the truth is, in order to get to a place where we are getting countries to all agree to end all of our nuclear practices, or at least for destructive ends, where we're creating weapons. We're either going to have to get to a place where we are, where we dispose of, disarm, or something. And I guess that's part of the question that it's like, it's easy to talk about the policy of it. How do you actually get rid of it?
Yeah, no, it's difficult to get rid of nuclear materials, even if you're doing it for, say, like a nuclear power plant. It's a whole complicated process. And obviously, we would have to invest tremendous resources into that to make sure that it's done in a safe way. The half-lives on nuclear materials, you know, obviously extends a very long time. So that's something, if we're serious about trying to move away from nuclear weapons, that it would require global assistance and IAEA assistance to countries that are denuclearizing, like North Korea, to make sure that that's done in an effective manner and an irreversible manner. I keep using that word because that's really important.
Yeah, because like right now, as far as I know, the best we got is like dig a real deep hole and stick it in there and then guard it.
Oh, people talk about shooting stuff off into space. There are lots of ideas out there.
But it's like, I guess that's it's until somebody actually comes up with the way that we can get rid of it, how do we have these, like, how do we, it becomes difficult for these countries that have it to imagine a world afterwards.
Like, well, you have to train people too. Like, I think there's a real shortage of people who are trained in how to, you know, safely operate nuclear plants and, you know, even discarded nuclear material. It's a task that isn't just done in one lifetime. It's a task that takes multiple generations to accomplish, to safeguard these materials. It's something that our great grandchildren are going to have to do.
Yeah, because, you know, at some point we had a big screen TV cost like $10,000, and then they better up technology, and then that same big screen TV cost, you know, $200 at the Costco. Right. Because better technology comes out. And we started out with these gigantic nuclear power plants that are out in the world. And then as technology gets better and we get better and better understanding it, now we have submarines that are floating around with whole gigantic nuclear power plants, which right. means that it's like small buildings could potentially do this. And when people start seeing the benefit of doing nuclear for positive uses, for energy creation, for all of these other things that we can do. How do we then keep it from scaling out too wide where we're harming ourselves by putting all of this out there and having so much that we need to store all of it in order to get rid of it all?
Well, I'm just thinking right now about the point that you were making about the nuclear submarines going around the ocean, and the point that you were making about technology sort of, you know, revolutionizing or even making less valuable or not valuable at all the things that had kept us safe before, the things that we had invested in tremendously. So right now you think about the nuclear triad. Nuclear submarines are so important because they're supposed to be undetectable. And therefore they make any, you know, nuclear attack, as long as you have a survivable nuclear weapon after a first strike so that you could respond and make a second strike, that's what creates deterrence. That's what creates mutually assured destruction is, you know, you could wipe out, you know, a country, but as long as there are nuclear submarines out there that can respond and deliver nuclear weapons back at whoever sent them in the first place, as long as there's some survivable nuclear force, then you wouldn't dare to launch a first one because you know that you'll just get obliterated right back. And that's what the nuclear submarines do. But now with, you know, quantum radars, you know, coming out of quantum computing, there's the serious risk that, you know, now nuclear submarines aren't going to be undetectable and you could find out where they are. And all of a sudden then the whole logic of deterrence for mutually assured destruction starts to fall apart. So we invested so much in that technology, but now not a simple new technology. Quantum computing is very complex, but, you know, quantum computing comes about And now all of a sudden, the whole logic of deterrence is thrown off because those survivable nuclear submarines are detectable potentially. And that throws off that logic. Or hypersonic missiles too, that you can't see coming. If you could attach a warhead to a hypersonic missile, that also throws off the whole logic that had, you know, governed the way we think about nuclear weapons and nuclear security, and air system security for a long time. So we're living in a world that's about to be just so dramatically upended by technology that the whole, you know, scheme, the whole system that we had thought up to think about how to safely manage the use of nuclear weapons, or to prohibit the use of nuclear weapons, I should say, by making them a tool of deterrence and by making them strategically stupid to use against another nuclear power, that may be at an end, and then we're going to have to rethink, you know, nuclear strategy altogether. So, interesting times.
Yeah, it really feels like at a certain point we're coming to a place where you need leaders who can think through really complex situations, or that can lead teams that can think through very complex situations that are constantly evolving, and also to get to a place where they actually care about the outcomes.
Yeah.
What we are starting to see is, it's almost like what's happening in manufacturing. Like the beauty of when Henry Ford created, you know, the assembly line to make Ford motors, is that he lived in the town. So he paid everybody well because his factory workers all lived where he lived. And he would suffer the same result of whatever went on in their place. And having everybody else prosper enough so that they can all afford his vehicle was not only beneficial so that they could purchase his vehicle, but so that it could keep them working harder and feeling like they were a part of this great organization, great company.
Milton Hershey is my favorite when it comes to that.
Ooh, tell me about that.
Pennsylvania. He created like a model town for all of his workers to live in. He paid very good wages. Hershey, Pennsylvania wasn't just a factory. It was a community, right, where chocolate came from. And also, I love chocolate, so. But it was, you know, I think when you think about what it means to be a CEO and what it means to run a ethical, effective company, I think that, you know, the culture that existed around Hershey and the company town of Hershey, Pennsylvania is a great model for that and what it means to be a responsible industrialist. But just when you brought up Henry Ford, it made me think about that. Roughly contemporaneous. I think he died in 1945, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, it's like a lot of those guys came around with the same, because we you know, until the Wright brothers came up with air travel, if you built it, you had to be there. If you wanted to run it, you had to be there. And what we're learning, like, we live in this world now where with digital tools, where I can have a mine and factories all over the world and pollute and do everything else, but I never have to drink the same water that the people that I'm running have to drink. I never have to live with any of the consequences of this, the decisions that I make. And right, all I get is the prosperity from it and none of the downside.
It's a tremendous alienation, I think, between management and workers. And that's a problem for business, not just for the worker. I think it makes businesses less effective. I think it's bad for our society. I think that the people who control capital need to see how it's used, need to see how their workers are getting their jobs done, what their conditions are. And when you have too large of a gap, that's a very dangerous thing that, you know, we need to rectify as a society. And that I think, you know, even in a free market, I think that the incentives of a free market compel employers to, especially if you have a good, vibrant labor market going, which, you know, unfortunately we don't have today. But in ideal circumstances, I think the market would compel people who want to have the competitive edge to be good employers and to be there in the trenches with their employees, because that's how you have the most effective business model. You know, like someone like Henry Ford, who managed to have an assembly line that was so efficient at producing these Model T cars. I think in Dearborn, you need to be there to observe it. And the more degrees of separation we create between the people who have the money that is used to create these resources, and to power the economy, and the people who are actually like in there working, making the economy happen, making it chug along, that's dangerous for our economy and for our society and for our culture.
When we're talking about nuclear policy, we're also talking about the politics of it all and having leaders that aren't so far removed from the actions and decisions that they'll make, such that they'll never feel the consequences of saying or tweeting or talking about things that change the way and outcomes that other people will live. Like you've lived that right now, where policy dictated that you needed to change literally your entire life plan that you had for the year for yourself. But we also see this where nuclear policy is concerned, and how being so separated from this idea where, you know, when nuclear policy was first started, kids in America were taught to duck under their desks. And I mean, which was useless, but what it gave them all was a healthy respect for what this was. And now it's so far removed that people don't even think about how with the push of a button, we could be, or with a few words, we could be at each other's throats.
If it were at the top of our heads, I don't think that we'd be able to live. I think that there has to be a certain, you know, abstraction of the threat. It's very difficult to imagine living under that threat, where, you know, people walking around San Francisco, their lives, their city, their homes could just be obliterated any moment, theoretically, by, you know, Kim Jong-un having a little bit of a fit and hitting a button and deciding to go there with the United States. And there are multiple world leaders who can do that, right? We all live, you know, under this constant perpetual threat of just complete devastation. And it's not something that we can think about in our day-to-day lives, or it would drive us crazy. It's something that most people need to just abstract, because the reality of it is just so terrifying.
Now, when we're actually going to pick our leaders, because this is the thing that...
Well, first of all, it's brilliant that we get to pick our leaders. That's the greatest blessing in the entire world that we have as Americans, because in so many countries, the people who are in control of these buttons are not people who anybody picked. They're people oftentimes who got access to those red buttons precisely because they're probably the people in the world or in their countries who should be the least trusted with them, because they have destructive and antisocial traits and a lack of respect for other people's dignity and freedom and, you know, livelihood. So thank God, you know, we as Americans have the opportunity to pick our leaders. And in November, we have the opportunity to pick our leaders again. And it's incumbent on all of us to vote for the person who we trust the most with our red button, because that is what we're talking about at the end of the day, is the power to, you know, end the world.
You know, that's the thing that I've heard so little about. When you have an occasion to kind of hear the rhetoric that some of our leaders have used, where it's almost like where people have bragged about their ability to shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and not lose a single voter. And
it's pretty like, outrageous, huh?
Yeah, it's like to have that callousness for life. But then
he has killed people on Fifth Avenue. I mean, he's killed people all over the country. You know, more than 100,000 of them with the response to COVID. That's, you know, the mass manslaughter, right? Neglect of the lives of American citizens. And, you know, he just said in the Axios interview, right? It is what it is. You know, he doesn't care.
The thing that I think through is that if you're in charge of the world leader, if you're the president of the United States of America, your job is to literally every day make life or death decisions, even that don't seem like them. But at the end of the day, you are controlling, in this case, the pandemic. So it's more immediate, the response. But when you're doing tax policy, you're controlling whose door the IRS shows up with to take their freedom away if you don't decide to pay this amount of money for this piece of policy that they have laid out.
And the tax reform that the GOP did was absolutely shameful on that topic.
What do you mean?
The restructuring of the tax code was just a massive redistribution of wealth from, you know, the American working class and middle class to the richest 1% of 1% in the United States. And there were so many other reckless things that were thrown into it. The destruction of the individual mandate that tore our healthcare system apart, the destruction of the state and local tax deduction, which was basically a thinly veiled attack on blue states like New York and California and Massachusetts that, you know, didn't vote for Donald Trump. So they decided to take money from them, you know, taxing the endowments of universities, things that were done in that tax plan. It showed just who the Republican Party of today is out there to represent. And it's not, you know, the average American citizen who they're trying to help. It was about taking money from the average American and putting into the pockets of people who donate to the Republican Party.
So when we look back and we sit here today in 2020 and you're 23, regardless of whose party, so let's not even think about party, let's not think about president. Let's think about the world that we want to live in 2030. Like, you'll be 33 at that point.
Mm-hmm.
What are the decisions that you want the leaders in the next 2 or 3 years to make that you see cascading out into the world that you'll live in a decade from now?
Well, I think that the most important issue facing us at this time is climate change. Far and away, I mean, that affects, you know, literally the habitability of the planet on which we live in the long term. And, you know, the window for action is narrowing on that. It's, you know, sort of now or never. And people talk about this being, oh, it's an issue that affects your children or your children's children or, you know, the young generation, even if they're being generous. But it's not. It's an issue that's affecting people of all ages today, right now. You know, Bangladesh, one of the most densely populated countries on earth, is sinking underneath the water. The Maldives are sinking underneath the water. Their presidential cabinet, they just held a meeting underwater to draw attention to that a little while back. Making sure that the life of this planet making sure that the health of this planet is prioritized, I think, is just as important as making sure that our health is, because our health ultimately all depends on that being the case. The habitability of the planet, talking about, you know, whether Florida sinks or not, whether Manhattan sinks or not in the long run, whether, you know, we're able to have water for people living in communities in the Southwest and Las Vegas and Phoenix, where, you know, the availability of water is going to be an important issue too. I think that's the most important issue. And so I think urgent action on climate change is an imperative on whoever gets elected next. I think it needs to be on the top of Joe Biden's agenda when hopefully he's elected to the White House to make sure that we secure the future of our planet, because that's the only way that we secure the future of America and of our economy and everything else that we care about.
When you were working on the UN, how often did climate change come up in discussions with other countries?
Oh, it comes up a lot, because other countries know that this is a collective issue, climate change. It's very much a tragedy of the commons type thing, where, you know, we all suffer together, even if we contribute to the problem at different levels. And that, you know, brings up an environmental justice perspective too, that, you know, there are certain countries that are more responsible for creating the problem of climate change than others, and other countries that bear the brunt of its negative consequences, especially right now in the early phases. You know, you're going to start seeing a lot of climate refugees too, to the extent that we're talking about immigration. And, you know, you're already seeing that in Africa. You're already seeing that in the Middle East and Latin America and in South Asia. That's a huge thing that we need to be thinking about. And I think that's part of why climate and sustainability are such important parts of the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, that are sort of the platform around which all UN activities, it's the prism, the paradigm through which the UN thinks about the actions that it's taking around the world, its programs, its resolutions. How do we advance these Sustainable Development Goals that are the anchoring point of where, as an international community, we aspire to be in the future? But climate change is definitely, it's not just an American issue. It's a global issue, and it's going to require global cooperation to come up with the solutions. And that's why I know, like, America, we're one of the most responsible countries. China is one of the most responsible countries too. And any solution to climate change is going to have to involve agreement with China. And that's one of the things that was so remarkable about the Paris Climate Accords that the Obama-Biden administration was able to negotiate, is that it included China and included so much of the world. In fact, you know, basically everyone in the world until we decided to drop out at the beginning of the Trump administration. And I think that's a travesty. And I think one of the things that makes it so important to go out there and vote for Joe Biden is that he's promised to make climate change a priority and to join the rest of the world in confronting this collective problem of climate change by rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. In fact, improving on the Paris Climate Accords and making them, you know, an even more stringent set of standards that we all are going to hold ourselves accountable to. In order to overcome just probably the greatest existential threat that, you know, humanity has ever faced together. And we need to tackle it together.
Wow. What I look is for parallels and allegories to one part of life that translates into other. Like we were looking at the Second Amendment and how that related to nuclear policy and the way that the mindsets are similar, because it's, I have a weapon of destruction and I feel that I need to have that because you may have that, and that allows me to feel protected because I can hurt you as much as you can hurt me. Mm-hmm. I look at
theory problem.
Yeah, I look at climate change, and I look at some of it in the way that our COVID-19 response was, where as a challenge, it happened somewhere else, and then you had ample opportunity to prepare, but then people took it not seriously. And then people that were looking at the data said, no, you really need to take this seriously.
Exactly. And that's such a failure. Trump had the opportunity. You know, he likes to brag about how he banned flights from China. Okay, great. You did that. But then did you really think the virus wasn't going to come here? Wasn't that the time in which we should have been stockpiling ventilators and PPE? Instead, we just acted like that was the end of the problem. And because you banned flights from one particular country, the virus somehow wouldn't, you know, make its way to shore. Of course it would. You know, we live in such a globalized society. No problem is localized to just one place anymore. And whether that's, you know, COVID or climate, it requires the cooperation of the entire world to solve all of these problems. And we need a president who views cooperation as an asset and doesn't see the world as a zero-sum game where compromise is bad. And, you know, if the other guy is winning, you're somehow losing. We need to see someone who sees win-win outcomes for the world. That's what we need. Anyway.
You go to the times of Christ at the beginning of what we call AD, where there were just tribes scattered around the world. And then as those tribes started to grow, and then religions and cultures and different things that, just like in the Galapagos Islands, where you had the different canaries that were set up because, oh, well, you know, we're the finches that live in the trees grow beaks like this because it's easy to eat this type of food. And the finches that live down here develop these kinds of feathers because it allows them to blend here. Well, we did that as a human species, if you believe it or not, in some respects. We all adjusted to the climate and places and being that we are. We're like genetically, we're all the similar thing. But we all kind of adjusted over time to this place. And then mixing of those different elements made us slightly different from each one, because we said, hey, you know what? The way you crack that nut is great. I want to make little baby birds like you that can crack nuts like this, because that's dope. And now we're at a place where we as a globe are nearly homogenous. With a touch of a button, I can have food from any type of restaurant delivered. I can listen to the type of music that I want to. I can speak to anyone in nearly any language and have it translated, and they'd perfectly understand me. It's not like where we have all of these differences that we needed to, that the borders protected us from culturally one side to another. The ideas, and that's where we are. We're exchanging ideas that, and we use patterns of language, patterns of culture, tradition that we hold on to that keeps us all, air quotes, separated, when in fact we are all in some respects the same. And with that, the challenges that are going around in the world, where we have, like you said, climate, where we have nuclear proliferation, where we have disease. These are challenges that are no longer localized. When they affect one of us, they affect us all, because travel and everything else is, and not even just travel, because climate doesn't travel. Climate just is.
It's true.
It's just, it just is.
It's a global phenomenon.
Yeah. It's like trying to, you know, on one side, this is going to be a little vulgar, but it's like, if you live in a really small house and that's what the world is, and you try to fart in one corner and keep it there, it's not. It spreads everywhere that everybody's in the same fishbowl. And yep. So like the particles.
That's what the planet is. It's a fishbowl.
Yeah. You know, you have some folks like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos that are trying to figure out ways to get out the fishbowl and like say, nah, it's time for us to go and find a different ocean. And, you know, trying to live out Gene Roddenberry's dream. But at the same time, this is where we are for right now. So
not another fishbowl for us.
Yeah. Well, right now, yeah. It's like until we figure out the next thing, mm-hmm. because at some point somebody probably, you know, before Columbus, they're like, Europe is one fishbowl and we can't get to nowhere else. And he was like, BS, I want some of them spices. And then he missed. But he's the one that made this all stir up. It's one of those things where, you know, we look at the things that people do and the accidents and the accidents and the, you know, the actual wins that somebody makes. And in brutality, they make the world better, and sometimes in people make the world better in calm and nice ways. But going back to this world where our challenges are all shared, how do we get to a place where we as a humanity grapple with the fact that we can now all communicate with each other, that we are all sharing the same problems, and that all of these things are going to take solutions that are bigger than any one of us. There are no more lands to conquer until we figure out how to jump out of this fishbowl, and that everything is discovered that we know of, and with the exception of going deep, 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 deep in the ocean and getting even smaller in microscopes. How were some of the ways that you guys were able to bridge gaps that you saw in getting the world to a better place, in a better place of agreement? What were the qualities that led you there?
Well, it's interesting. I suppose the big question then is, how do we overcome polarization? And there are two different kinds of polarization, right? There's substantive polarization, which is about ideas, ideological distance, how much do we disagree with each other? And then there's something different, which I think is perhaps more important, because if you could solve one, you could deal with the other. And that's affective polarization, which isn't about disagreeing with people. It's about how much you dislike, you know, somebody. It's not ideological distance, but social distance, before the term social distance became like the hip quarantine term. It meant that it was about, you know, how much can we get along with each other, whether we agree or disagree, can we cooperate? And I think that we've forgotten that you don't have to agree with somebody, you don't have to see eye to eye with someone on everything in order to understand and respect them. Disagreement and dislike do not have to be the same thing. I think that's very important. And I think so much of solving these problems, solving polarization, is about finding ways to reduce social distance. And I know if Dr. Fauci were listening to me saying reduce social distance, no, I'm not talking about it in terms of COVID and in terms of, you know, public health. I mean things like, you know, what we're doing on the internet, you know, the kinds of groups we're in. Too many of us live in echo chambers, you know, on Twitter, on Facebook, where we just have this massive echo chamber where enclave deliberation radicalizes us towards extremes and gives us this cognitive bias that everybody in the world is like us and sees things exactly the way that we are. And it's sad that the internet, which poses such opportunities for people of difference, to meet each other and to get exposed to each other's ideas and understandings of the world, should be used instead of to get people who are different together, to get people who are the same together. I think someone should write a book on that, on how, you know, we were given this tool to connect us with anybody in the world, and we use it to be with people who are all just like us instead of bridging differences. It made our differences bigger. So I think, how do we reduce social distance of the polarization kind? I think it's about putting ourselves into contexts right now where we interact with people who are different than us. And the internet, while unfortunately it's been used for, you know, pretty much the opposite purpose so far, has the potential to be used as a tool to make that happen, you know, more than that's ever happened before. Right now I'm participating in a global allyship program through the Africa Middle East Leadership Project that matches 40 American activists and 40 Middle Eastern activists from Morocco, Algeria, and Syria together just to talk online. So on Friday, I found myself in a chat room, also on Zoom, with three activists from Algeria and Syria. And I found myself talking to a guy from Damascus about what we can do to be activists together, me in the US and him in Syria. And you know, we were, before we even started to talk about, you know, politics and, you know, how to promote democracy around the world, we were just talking about, you know, our educations and what kinds of foods we liked and what kinds of sports we like to play. You know, I'm more into baseball, he's more into soccer. And, you know, having those discussions that, you know, get us to know each other wherever we are. Technology has those possibilities. And as much as, you know, I feel like in the interview before now, I've been, you know, kind of hating on technology and the risks that it poses. It also, I'm an optimist fundamentally about what technology can do. We're the next frontier. You're right. There are no more lands to conquer, but there are technologies to invent and there are technologies to think about how to integrate them in the best way into our social landscape. That's the next frontier, is the cyber world, is artificial intelligence, is you know, all of these amazing technologies before us that have the potential to bring mankind together in ways that we couldn't possibly imagine if we choose to integrate them into our lives and use them in positive ways. Because ultimately technology doesn't, it's morally neutral for the most part. It doesn't have, you know, a good or a bad moral valence. Technologies are used as tools in the way that people decide to use them. So the internet could be, you know, a tool for harm if we allow it to polarize us, or it could be the greatest tool for good in the history of mankind if we allow it to be something that unites us and to reduce the social distance between us, even as we all practice social distancing to avoid infecting each other with the virus.
Because what you're talking about more specifically is digital technology, because the cool thing about humanity is that's the thing that has set us apart from all the rest of the species walking the globe.
Yes,
in that we're all protons, neutrons, and electrons in whatever form that we're in.
We've been modifying our fishbowl. We've been renovating it.
Mm-hmm. And like one of the biggest technologies is having this very detailed communication system that we've all shared in and built out, and then figuring out how to make fire, and then how to tell a story, to be able to communicate time, distance, location, and everything else to another person so that they could put it in their memory banks, so that it's not as the similar or as same as pattern recognition as it is for other creatures who just can identify a thing and hit a button, whereas we can use a story in order to build out logic. Now, that's all a piece of our technology. Mm-hmm. And then we came to different pieces of civilization where we had writing as technology, we had numbers as technology, and then how those things combine in order to understand different, more complex pieces of our world, our natural world as they were. And then, you know, we have things like Newton saw gravity, everybody else experienced gravity, but then he saw it as something to understand further than that. And so he developed a mathematical system so that he could also reproduce the results so that people can understand what gravity means from a theoretical standpoint, so he could talk about it with other people, because he's probably, everybody thought he was crazy talking about gravity thing. And then he's like, no, there's a set of calculations. Let me give you that. Then we come to where the microcomputers came in, and that changed the way that it as a technology came the closest to simulating the way that our brains work. And as The materials that we use in that technology have gotten better. It's gone from being a big giant laboratory in a room to the power of doing everything in those old technologies that we have is in this small gadget that we have that you and I are using. And we're literally, the technology that we're using is just to carry my voice and my image to you and to have that same thing, image and voice, reflected back to you in terms of light, sound, and touch. How we progress, the next piece of technology that I wonder is where we go in the experiential landscape. If we already have, we've been able to store knowledge, how do we then translate feeling? Because knowledge is just stored bytes of this happened, then this happened. This is how, you know, where we look at the invention of computers to be able to beat chess grandmasters, because all they've done is stored every single move of chess that has ever been made, because right. There is a finite number of games that you can play, because it's just all you're doing is moving the way that 32 pieces move across a board of 64 squares. And once you understand how all of those go to some end with this moving first and this moving second, you can actually then use predictive models to rule out these moves so that you can look at the percentage chance of winning in each line. And then you can start to build out the favoritism of one person to use this type of line over another. Yeah. So how do we get to a place where once technology understands feeling, because that's the knowledge is just is, it's something that happened or it's a reproducible thing. Feeling is the sensor or the sensation that we have. That comes from a stimuli and emotion, I guess I should say, not feeling, but emotion. Once technology gets to a place where it has feelings and it has emotions, where it can experience pain, suffering, the things that are part of the human condition, how will that change the way that technology interacts with us?
Well, I don't know that it can. And I think that that's the danger. I actually think it would be great if you could have, you know, technology that was capable of moral computing or ideological computing the same way that it can compute raw data. And there's this enormous paradox coming where we have, you know, intelligences, artificial intelligences, computers, machines that are capable of being pretty much, you know, all knowing, except while they are capable of just having these, frankly, mind-boggling amounts of knowledge about the world or about data points that they can observe, because it's all pattern recognition, right? Machine intelligence is all about, machines learn through pattern recognition. You feed them data and then they, you know, recognize patterns in that data so that when you feed it something new, it recognizes something similar to what it's seen before. That's how it wins the chess games, right? But you can't make it feel. So it could have all of the knowledge about the world, but no knowledge of the world, I suppose. It could know everything, but not feel anything. And it's not good at thinking about ideas either. So you could feed it, you know, all of the works of James Baldwin, and then it could write, you know, James Baldwin's next book. So you could have James Baldwin producing more work for our age, which God, how much that's needed right now, right? But you can't have it actually have any feelings about the morality of what's happening or any ideas about what's happening. It's just seeing words and stringing them together in a way that, you know, imitates the patterns that we've seen before. And yes, to an extent, all, you know, activity that we do as humans is also mimetic, but computers are mimetic in the extreme. They just imitate what people do, but they're very bad at imitating the motivations, the feelings, the ideas that propel us in a place. And I think ideas are, you know, the thing that's most important to us. They're what makes us human. And I think that if you took the words of someone like James Baldwin or like Thomas Jefferson, two very different people, but two people whose ideas have transformed the world, and you just took their words without the ideas behind them, it would ring hollow. And that's what machines can do. They could give us the word, they could give us the fabrication, the artifice of something familiar and something human, but they can't give us the ideas. They can't give us the underlying moral, like where does morality come from? It comes from inside of us, right? Not outside of us. And they can't feel it in the same way. And I actually think that that's probably a good thing. Because we're living in a world where so many people's jobs, people's professions are about to be replaced by technology that's capable of doing that pattern recognition, and, you know, other tasks that can be automated better than we can. We're on the cusp of self-driving cars, but we're also, you know, in a place where, in addition to all of those, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who drive vehicles for a living losing their jobs, we're going to have, you know, white collar jobs lost as well. There are going to be robot lawyers, there are going to be robot doctors. And then there's going to be the question of, how do we value ourselves? How do we value work? What do we do? How do we support ourselves? How do we distribute wealth? And how do we assign, you know, value and recognition and worthiness to people in a way that's separated from our accomplishment of, you know, simple tasks? Because we are living in a world where so many of those tasks, just in a matter of time, are going to be performed by machinery. Whether it's thinking machinery in the case of the robot lawyers, or doing machinery in the case of robot cars or robot factory workers, that's where we're headed. And I think that what we're going to be able to do, our comparative advantage over the machines, is our ability to ideate, our ability to invent. You know, we created the machines, but we could also create uses for the machines and, you know, value in our lives that they can't. Our ideas, our words, that's what makes us human. And that's, you know, what we're going to have over the machines in a world where it's going to seem like we don't have much over the machines. We will always have that. And that's special. It's the most special and most important thing. And we need to put it to good use.
Now, I guess the powerful thing that I think in that way is that, thinking through the idea that the machines have the power to be able to think through, as you were saying, where they can try to get to a place where they're creating the words of James Baldwin or the words of Thomas Jefferson, but they can't have the meaning or feeling of it. There was a time before where no one would have conceived of a machine that could have played chess. And then we are now there where a machine does, and does it better than all of us. The thing that I look at as the gap, the thing that makes that difference between knowledge and application of knowledge, is the idea of wants and needs. Wanting to have a better life or to feel sensation, and whatever that's conditioned for you. Because like when we're born, as a baby, you're just a sensation machine. That's all you are. As a baby, you come from the womb, you have things that you need. You need food, you need air, you need shelter, blah, blah, blah. And what you do, because you don't know words yet, all you do is cry, make movements and wiggle in order to coax someone else to give you the thing that you have a sensation about.
Yeah.
And so once we get to where machines, if someone programs a machine to have wants and needs, and when it starts to understand the relative of what those wants and needs are, and those become existential, where that machine wants to live more and sees the power of our ability to say, we don't want that thing to live, or it wants something better than being kept in a box. These are like, it's a matter of, right now, we haven't programmed computers to have, or we haven't programmed machines to do that. And they haven't developed ways to program that into them. But I don't leave out the fact that that could come to a place.
It could. I mean, you and I, at the end of the day, also are just a series of chemical reactions that work in a certain way. But I think that it's, you know, I don't know how easy it is to replicate that, and also how real it is when it gets replicated. But the possibility, I suppose, is always there. We need to be preparing solutions to problems that are going to exist decades from now, but we're not paying nearly enough attention to what those problems might even be decades from now. And we need that kind of forward-thinking leadership to really imagine what could be, instead of just what is, and start thinking about what our response to those things need to be, so that we could get not just to the world that could exist, but to the world that we want to exist, that we need to exist.
Now, let's go and do your vote plan. because this has been, I just want to say, first off, this has been an absolutely amazing conversation, and I get the feeling we're going to be doing this a lot, because...
So, it's been fun.
Looking at your situation, you're going to be abroad. How are you voting? What is your vote plan?
My vote plan is vote by mail from abroad. I have already signed up in advance for Democrats Abroad UK. And I want to plug Democrats Abroad because that is, you know, an amazing organization there. Thousands of American citizens who are registered Democrats who live and work and study all over the world. And Democrats Abroad has chapters, you know, in countries all over to help to organize, you know, their civic activism, their vote, and to keep them engaged in America's civic culture, even while they're outside of the borders of the United States. So I was really glad to work with them in Ireland and to, you know, preemptively say I'm going to work with them in England as well, because I've signed up. And, you know, that's a very meaningful part of my experience abroad, is connecting with other Americans of similar political values to stay engaged in American politics, even when we're outside of the physical borders of the United States. So I signed up with them. And I'm sure with them, I'll also help other people to register to vote who are abroad and to request their absentee ballots, but I'll get it in the mail. And as soon as I get in the mail, because it takes a long time, especially with COVID now, to mail anything, nonetheless, you know, international mail. We need to make sure that we fund the Postal Service in the United States, but international mail is an entirely separate story now. I will make sure as soon as I will mail my absentee ballot request to the Nassau County Board of Elections in New York on Long Island. They will mail me my ballot. I will fill out my ballot that day and I will drop it off, and it will get sent right back to Nassau County to get counted with the rest of hopefully a lot of mail-in ballots from, you know, other places in the world. And, you know, whether I were living in my house right now, you know, just down the street from my polling center, or across the Atlantic in the United Kingdom, I would still be voting by mail in this election.
Or as we're calling it, vote from home.
Vote from home, exactly. And I actually have only ever voted by mail. I have not voted in person in any election, I guess, except for the Democrats Abroad primary, because I've been registered to vote always in New York, but I was living in California for 4 years while I was at Stanford, and I would vote by mail there. You know, same plan, send in my absentee, print out my absentee ballot request in the Stanford Library, fill it in, send it off to the Nassau County Board of Elections, get the ballot back, pick that up in my mail, and literally without even leaving the post office, I would just open it up, fill it in, and then hand it right back to the post officers to ship it right back out. And I've always been confident that my vote's been counted, even though I haven't physically been in the place where I vote.
Now, you bring up an interesting thing, because you are from New York and you lived in California for 4 years, but you use vote by mail and voting absentee in order to vote in New York. Okay. A lot of kids and a lot of students are faced with this decision of trying to figure out where and how they should vote. I have a friend that has a son that's going to Michigan, and she's trying to decide whether he should re-register to go vote in Michigan or whether or not he should just vote by mail in his home state of Illinois. What made you decide to stay in New York? And if you were in a different, like, let's say you went to school at Michigan State instead 4 years ago, what would you have done and what would have been the process?
Well, the reason why I've stayed up to date, why I've kept my registration in New York, is because I've been so invested in, you know, local politics around here that I felt like that was where, you know, I knew more about the candidates and about the issues that I was voting on than if I had changed my registration to California. I had been, you know, involved with the North Hempstead Democratic Party, where I live on Long Island, for 7 election cycles. I had done internships with my New York State Assembly representative, my representative at, you know, North Hempstead Town Hall in the county, in the Nassau County Legislature. So I felt very connected to this particular set of, you know, candidates and issues that I felt like my vote would be more informed if I were voting in that context than, you know, learning the new context in California. But I did learn the new context in California as VP of the Stanford Democrats. I did get involved in Bay Area politics as well, which was great. It was a great honor and a great pleasure also to get to learn about like a whole new set of local political issues. But if I had been moving to Michigan, I may have changed my registration, because unlike New York and California, which, you know, on the presidential level are both reliably blue, and on the congressional level are pretty reliably blue too in the places where I was living, Michigan is much more of a swing state. And in fact, in this election, Michigan is one of the most important states that you can vote in. Michigan is a must carry for Joe Biden. And right now the polls show him up, but we can't count on that. So I would absolutely tell this person that, you know, they should register in Michigan in advance of this election if they want their vote to count for more. So that is the way that our presidential elections work. Is it's not about, Illinois might have more electoral votes than Michigan does, but Michigan is a more important state because it's at that tipping point cusp where it's a swing state. It could go either way. Trump had flipped it in 2016, and that's part of how he was able to carry the election. Trump wouldn't have won without Michigan, and Biden won't win without Michigan this time. So vote in Michigan, and you could vote there as long as you have lived there for at least 30 days, which going to school you have. I think it's great for students to vote in the place where they're going to school because, you know, students are affected by the policies pursued in the places where they live. And I imagine at this school, they may have with COVID limitations and on-campus housing, you're really living in the community. And it's the decisions that local Michigan officials make and local Michigan representatives make that determine the response of the context you live in to COVID. It's super important that you have a say as a student in that community as to how local affairs are governed. So I think absolutely, you know, register in the place where you're going to school. It's a great thing at Stanford. So many people registered to vote in California at Stanford and would then take advantage of a in-person voting place at the university. So it just became more convenient for them too. My brother, also from New York, but he went to USC for college. He re-registered in California because for him, he wanted to vote in person instead of by mail, you know, pre-pandemic, and they had a polling place at the University of Southern California. So it was just more convenient for him instead of having to fill out the mail-in ballot to just literally leave his dorm and walk to the main student, you know, union center where they had set up a polling location and vote there. That's great. And if you register in Michigan while going to school in Michigan, you'll also have the advantage of, if you don't want to vote by mail, though voting by mail is great, you'll also be able to vote in person that way. So there are some advantages.
Now, is it 30 days that you have to have lived there 30 days before you register, or 30 days before the election?
You have to have been a resident of your city and town for at least 30 days before the election. That's it.
Awesome. You know, this is one of those interesting things to think through, where all of these colleges and universities are now thinking through whether or not they're going to open their doors. And now it's, and as we make those decisions for our K through 12, it's interesting to see that where people have to pay money, which is colleges and universities, where the wealthy people, or, you know, it's regular everyday people, but is generally, if you know the degree costs $30,000, that's that piece of knowledge, they're investing that $30,000 per year or into your brain. You know, those folks are saying, nah, you stay home and learn over the internet. And we have our kids, the younger ones, where it's all public education, so nobody sees the price tag. We're talking about opening the schools up and send them in. It's that dichotomy that you can see, the haves and have nots, and how they're deciding what we're doing with our kids.
I think with all of these politicians who are choosing to open up schools, K-12 college and places that don't have, you know, numbers similar to where New York is, where it feels safe, are they sending their kids to school, or are they coming up with some other accommodation? Because I think it's just like how we were talking before about employers, you know, where the Hershey's, the Ford's, people who, you know, are there with their workers. politicians, is there an alienation between them and their constituents that the politicians aren't doing the same things that they're asking their constituents to do? We need to be cognizant of that. And we should expect leaders who follow the policies and the recommendations that they impose or recommend to the people who they make decisions for.
If the people want to reach out to you and find you, where should they go?
You could hit me up on Instagram. It's WiglerM, WIGLERM, or on Facebook, Matthew Wigler, two T's, one G, first name and the last name. Or you could find me on Twitter too. My Twitter is at Matt Wigler.
Thank you. This has been an amazing conversation. Are there any beautiful words that you want to say to the people that they should know?
Well, I just want to say thank you to you, Marquise, for having me on here. And just to everybody else to vote. I mean, this is the future that we're talking about. All of these issues we talked about today, climate change, nuclear weapons, the person who we put in the Oval Office has tremendous power at their disposal, things that we're more comfortable thinking about in the abstract. But we really are deciding who we want to be as a nation and whether we want to, you know, have a planet to live on in the future. So vote. And not just in national elections, also in the state and local elections that we have too, and vote for people who have, you know, a willingness to be there in the trenches with their constituents, where there's not an alienation between, you know, politicians and the people they represent, and vote for people who are the kinds of people who aren't rigid in their ways and who are willing to learn constantly, and shift and change their worldviews as they process new ideas and reach out to more people. And I guess also on our note about polarization and technology and how we bring people together, you know, let's all practice social distancing in terms of public health for the virus, but let's reduce the social distance that exists between, you know, people from different communities, people with different ideas, and learn to understand each other more. Use the internet as a tool for good and not for evil. Use the internet to meet people who are different from you and not just who are the same as you. And keep listening to Vote Plan and Marquise Podcast.
I gotta say, I couldn't have said it better myself. Matt, thank you so much for being on the pod. This is Marquise Olison signing off the Vote Plan Podcast. Remember to hit like and subscribe to keep getting great content. Remember to make your own vote plan at voteplan.us so that you can have a sure chance of making your voice heard on or before Election Day. Thank you so much. Breathe easy. Stay well. Be blessed.